Welcome. This is Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs doing episode number 61 in our investigation of what my book on Trump and the tech body, and what was it about, what was I attempting to say, and Cameron's helping me make a lot of discoveries about what the book shows. But if you are listening to us in episode 60, I brought up this quote. And this is an article from Rolling Stone magazine, November 12, 1970. A guy named Bren Stille, S-T-I-L-L-E-Y, he writes on a McLuhan talk, I think in San Francisco. And McLuhan went to some university auditorium. A lot of people were there. And it was titled, Marshall McLuhan, Culture Becomes Showbiz. And I don't know how accurate this quote was, but there seems to be a quote in the article saying, McLuhan saying, that the author highlighted, when writing was introduced in the 5th century B.C., it scrapped the old tribal traditions of Homer and Hesiod, but retrieved the private individual man, an ancient form dredged up from way, way back. Now, it's an astounding quote because generally the word private is a literate effect. So he's saying that the private individual man, the literate effect is that there is back there in caveman days, Paleolithic days, so to speak. But we know he doesn't mean the literate effect. So we got discussing it, Cameron and I, and I suggested it refers to the private citadel of consciousness. No, not, he doesn't say that in Counterblast. He says the citadel of consciousness. Well, he doesn't say private, I don't think. If you have that book there, Cameron, you quickly look it up. But the citadel of consciousness, says McLuhan, is not affected by media. So I was aware of that quote back in the 69, early 70s. I saw this article in 1970, so I would think about this. So I had certain ideas about it. So after we talked about it, because Cameron was still vague on it, he found some quotes. So in a letter to Joe Keough, July 6, 1970, letter 413, McLuhan says...
Page number.
Oh, this is in the book.
Yeah.
Okay. Letter number 413. Okay, yeah, page 413. Havelock's preface to Plato shows how the phonetic alphabet scrapped tribal man, but retrieved the primordial role of individual and pre-tribal awareness. Wow. And that's more what I imagine it was, but I never noticed that letter. You know, that was answering my question I had for all these years about what is this retrieved privacy. So he's saying it's pre-tribal, and he's not saying private. He's saying primordial. Now, the guy may have got the quote wrong in the article, but the point is something is back there that's individual. So that's really important. Now, Cameron, you were saying you didn't understand that quote when I mentioned it. I don't think you knew about it until I brought it up last week, right?
Well, I'd read it before.
Okay.
You know,
knew about
but,
it.
It's just you've actually brought it up a few times.
Yeah.
But I've never really understood what McLuhan was getting at. And even now, even though I've assembled a bunch of quotations about it, I'm still vague about
what
he was thinking about.
You had not... Look, you did not. This is the first time you found the quote, page 413, in line with this quote from the Rolling Stone magazine, which was a puzzle, and this gives you a bit of an answer. It gives you closer
Correct.
Stuff, right?
But that's not the only quotation I
yeah.
found. I found a whole series of them.
Right, which you had never noticed these quotes in relation to the Rolling Stone quote, with this mystery.
Correct. Well,
it's a great find.
Same as you, Bob.
Yeah, same as what? What's the same?
Same as you. Hadn't noticed them.
I had not noticed these quotes, no. I didn't know
yeah.
there was anything more. I always thought that was the only statement ever. But you
right.
got to read the letters closely, and there's a lot in the letters, so you miss things. So I haven't
yeah,
read
yeah.
the letters in years. I mean, I look at parts.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, McLuhan yeah. to Lynn White, August 17, 1970. I guess you found this in Andrew Crystal's thesis.
Correct.
He found this, probably at Ottawa, page 207, because
yeah.
it's not in the letters book.
Right.
Says, the liquidating of the tribal encyclopedia of the bards dot, 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 was done by phonetic literacy. But there was retrieved something of great antiquity, namely pre-tribal metaphysical man. These are like the most important quotes ever in McLuhan to me. I mean, these are tremendous, eh? What is pre-tribal metaphysical man? Now, in, right. I know in some other letter he says that the 20th century retrieved the metaphysical exploration of Greek culture. I think Greece invented metaphysics, sort of. Maybe it's
yeah, well, he obviously he's using terms like metaphysical in various ways.
Yeah, in the McLuhan way.
Metaphysics, yeah, I mean, he didn't, McLuhan really didn't care to define his terms very closely. So he was always just thinking, and then once he had done his thinking, his talking, his writing, he would sort of look back to see if anything had bubbled up to the surface.
Yeah, you were saying he would be doing his thinking and then he'd write something out, did you? Are you saying?
No, I'm saying that thinking, writing, talking, it was all one to McLuhan.
Yeah.
And he was, in all of those activities, he was just trying to see if something would bubble up to the surface.
And this bubbled, that, this is a thought that bubbled up that he yeah. was interested in because he repeats it. So here you have a 1970s note in the Global Village, but the Global Village is done in the mid-70s, right?
Yeah, well, the editor didn't bother to be very precise
yeah.
about where the stuff came from and when and all that. Well, so the Global Village itself was published, I think, in 88 or 89.
89.
Like that.
And
yeah.
you know the important note. He was going to put it out in 88, Oxford University Press, but Eric stopped it because Eric was putting out Laws of Media in 88, and he didn't want to be, you know, staged by Bruce Power, who had a bunch of tetrads. So
right.
somehow he had to back off. I don't know, based on what legalities or what actions were taken. So he put mm-hmm. his book out in 1989. And he, on the inside page forward or something, he has a note saying this book should have come out in 88, and he signs that note the date of Eric's forward in Laws of Media. He takes the same date. You could look that up. So it was a little
yeah,
dig there. But so the way I never heard anything about Bruce Powers when McLuhan was alive. But it turns out Bruce Powers was visiting McLuhan. It seems to be in the mid-70s. McLuhan wasn't doing much in 75, 76, really. So might have been started working on City's Classroom, but that was slow. So,
and that was nearly all old stuff that was just assembled
yeah.
For the book.
Yeah, you mean City's Classroom?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's now has this guy at Niagara Falls University or something, some university.
Yeah, Niagara University, yeah.
Yeah, and he was apparently former CIA. That came out somehow. Did you ever hear about that?
No.
Yeah, so so you see in his book, he's interested in intelligence issues, global empire and stuff, and satellite intelligence. So his interest in intelligence is in the book. He has more of that kind of stuff than anybody else.
Right. But McLuhan at the time was also tending in that direction.
Yeah, because that's where it was going. It was post-Watergate and all that stuff. The global theater surveillance was starting. So he was the perfect guy for McLuhan at that time. And so we take the mid-70s. So you have here 1970s note. It does not mean 1970. It means mid-70s. So this quote is page 98. The Electronic Society, dot, 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 can become boundless, directionless, falling easily into the dark of the mind. Now, the phrase "the dark of the mind" is the bog of speech in Counterblast before literacy. He talks about the dark swamp bog of speech in a tribal world.
Yeah,
remember that?
I have that quote right next.
Okay.
To the one you're. Yeah.
All right, so into the dark of the mind. Now, he usually doesn't use the word mind too much. You know what I mean? It's too vague. What the hell is the mind? Falling easily into the dark of the mind and the world of primordial intuitions. So good, we got primordial role, pre-tribal metaphysical, primordial intuition. Then he says, loss of individualism invites once again the comfort of tribal loyalties. That's the right. Electronic society brings back the comfort of tribal loyalties. And we have the loss of individualism, but that's generally seen as literate individualism. But he is saying the dark of the mind, the world of primordial intuition, so you link that back to the primordial role of individual. You agree
with
me?
Well, I mean, the sentence is very interesting. Loss of individualism invites once again the comfort of tribal loyalties. So take out once again. Loss of individualism invites the comfort of tribal loyalties.
Right.
So what he's saying there is that there was a kind of individualism prior to tribal.
Yeah. And that is never talked about.
Correct.
Yeah, that's very key.
And I know, as far as I'm concerned, the reason it's never, well, first off, people don't read McLuhan closely.
They don't even know he said it.
Yeah, but it's also a very, very difficult topic.
Yeah.
I have an idea now of what he meant, but I'm not sure about it.
Right, but the thing is, when he's talking about electric media, he says mass man is not tribal. So there's the autonomy factor, which I call chip body, TV body, and those things. This autonomy factor is coming in, which means the human is beyond any cultural conditioning or any government institutions. He's a new floating astronaut, cybernaut, going around the planet, even though it's not literally around the planet, but it's in there in your interior landscape. That autonomy, I think he is thinking that's a retrieval of this early pre-tribal condition.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
But right.
I would go a little bit further than that. I would say that, this is just my guess, I think that he's thinking about the pre-fall condition.
Yeah, yeah.
And that we're coming again to a crisis point where human beings either are going to retrieve their true inheritance,
yep,
or they're going to fall squared.
Would you say fall squared?
Yeah.
That's a good one. That's the squared aspect is in my chart, the Tynode chart. So, Cameron's picked
right,
up
I,
on that.
I take that from you, Bob.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to talk about it. So, now I see this is what Ion's all about. He talks about getting back to source energy, and Ion, he has this vision of people. The more ascended you are, the more whatever it is, you're not engaged in social communication that much. You don't need people. Now, this is tricky. If you go into the environment of the tech body, it's going to give everybody almost everything, but you'll be isolated. So you've got to figure out how to retrieve what's the mind for, what's communication for, any kind of communication with others, and how much do you need it to if you're feeling lonely or isolated. So that's the mm-hmm. dilemma we're in. And so actually, I would say, what did McLuhan talk about? He talked about the retrieval of pre-literate man, pre-tribal man. These quotes are very important because it brings McLuhan up to today and what the digital environment is doing to us. You know what I mean?
Well, where did you get them?
Where did I get what, the quotes?
Yeah.
Well, from a guy named Cameron McLuhan, the long-lost uncle of Marshall. But the thing, yeah, I got it from you. You found them. Well, that's what we do. We remind each other stuff, and then you go off and look and
correct.
Find stuff, and then you find stuff I didn't know. So this is cohabitation, isn't it? Isn't that what it's called?
There you go, yep.
I would say I'm the only person ever thought about it. I didn't know you were thinking about it, but I would think about this quote. And I kind of, the way we're talking about it, a pre-tribal, pre-cultural thing might be ascended position, I mean, there's all kinds of mythology and theosophy about Atlantis and whatever's going on back there, if there was a back there. But I never got beyond just thinking the way I'm talking about it. But these quotes support what I was thinking, but clarify it and even crystallize it. So I'm thinking clearer about it now, reading these, and I will announce that the new McLuhan that nobody noticed is about this retrieval. And I was just saying on the other show today, or the other day, that the enlightened ascended person, the aware person, is not dependent on social communication so much. And the fall was into speech, so a major innovation, and then everybody got lost in speech, and then all the emotional bonding of that led to what he says here, the comfort of tribal loyalties. That's a fallen state in relation to pre-tribal awareness. So I was explaining the comfort of communication. That's what we're addicted to today, always yeah. been. But it's
important to note that words like communication or social activity or something like this have very different meanings, right? So it's not the case that there's some kind of pre-communication state of humans. It's that communication is fundamentally different then. And what happens is you have a fall from the communications that's native to humans into a type of communication that they see as profit, but in fact robs them of themselves.
Yeah, it moves them out of the ESP, mental gesture. The phrase on Counterblast on page 23. He talks about the communication before speech. Now, I think he calls it mental gesture.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah,
yeah, and that's yeah. so the word of mental gesture.
Actually, that's another passage that could be added to this list.
Yeah, you should. That's a good point. And the beginning, page 16 or so of Finnegan's Wake, Joyce has Mutt and Jute, two guys talking, and I think he's showing the meeting of two individuals, this whatever they were, non-tribal, pre-tribal people. And so it's the beginning of effects, like they could bond after that, or they could bond and then at least all these other obligations and problems. So it's interesting that the Joyce begins the wake with two people talking, two people interacting with mental gesture. And it's covered because it's not just univocal. It's multiple language. You don't even know what they're saying. But that's a way of showing mental gesture. Because it shows a little bit of words, you can sort of guess at what they're saying, what they're matching on. Mm-hmm. So this is really
important.
Which
is all anybody can do in any language.
Yeah, and you know, Ian likes to say, well, these states that you're aspiring to, they're right there beside you. You're already engaged in them. So this way of mental gesture communication is happening in people today always. It always was. But it got overlaid by technologies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can lose yourself only to a certain extent.
Yeah. Yeah, you can never totally lose yourself.
Right.
So now,
that's the citadel.
Yes. And now Ion says that in death you do lose yourself. And that's a fallen state. Ion says that dying is not necessary, but people can't take the pain of existence for whatever reason. Maybe they start to fall into these technological hypnosis, beginning with speech and that. And so it creates pain, so every death's a suicide, Ion says. So they die, and they go into the guff, the Jewish term, and it's everybody feels really good, and there's no thought. So that's an aberrated state. And the new metaphysics, which are pretty profound, is that the guff has been canceled. It's not there anymore. So you're forced to live forever in the here, in this situation, but it can expand and not be limited to the 3D world. But you can't die to a comfortable place anymore. So that's another deep, unstated situation that's unique to what Ion says. And I find McLuhan, these kind of quotes, shows him groping towards that awareness of what I think Ion means. You know what I mean? What I project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I find that's why McLuhan fits into what Ion says. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it, once again, the comfort of tribal loyalties, that's a problem. Remember McLuhan says, I'm not into happiness. He says, I'm into suffering.
Yep.
That
mm-hmm.
means being able to take the existential condition of whatever it is, your expanded awareness, whatever the citadel is, it's not obliterating itself. You can by dying, but you don't have to. So these are very profound situations, which I will build a temporary religion and cult on, Cameron, over the next 20 years. I'm just telling you my secret plan. But anyways, that's a great quote. The loss of individualism invites the comfort of tribal loyalties. So then you go to 1954 counterblast, the original counterblast. Until writing was invented, we lived in acoustic space. Now, why would he sometimes say acoustic? Why wouldn't he say tactile space?
Well, in 54, he was just acoustic space was a new thing.
That's right. You say he doesn't really get tactility to 59-60.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that fits. Yeah, okay, that's good. We lived in acoustic space where the
Eskimo. He was at this time in 54 and for years after, he was thinking that acoustic space was a kind of answer to the problems of literate space, visual space.
Yeah.
And then he realized that, no, there's just as many problems. They're different, but there's just as many problems to acoustic space. So the whole question is one of needing balance between the two.
Yeah, he resolves it with tactility.
Is between the two, yeah.
Yeah. It'd be interesting, if anybody's listening, to see if they can see intimations of tactility in McLuhan's 53, 54, 1955 writings. Is it in there? Is Cameron correct that he really doesn't spell out till 59-60? Have you done that research? Can you say you have not found something?
No, I wouldn't even make that statement definitively. In my blog, I have done some tracing of tactility, so I would have to go there and look up
what you did
when he really begins to think about that. But I just off the top of my head, I think it's 60, 61 in that time period when he begins to think more about tactility, because he's thinking about vision and hearing needing to balance each other.
Wait, now just a second. I heard a bong. I go over here and speak. Say some words.
Hello, hello.
All right, that phone, Carolyn's phone disconnected.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if that stops the recording completely. Probably not. But let me get this back in there. It's not good to lose that. We never lose it. So normally I can hear you. It's not coming through. Mm-hmm. And I heard the little bunk that something, one of the phones disconnected. So let's just stop this one. I'll reconnect it.
Okay. Should I hang on, or do you want
yeah,
me to
no,
hang
just
up?
Stay there.
Welcome, and thank you for choosing freeconferencecall.com. You're helping people around the world communicate for free. Please enter your access code followed by the pound or hash sign.
That doesn't sound like a good announcement.
Please re-enter your access code
just a minute.
Followed by the pound or hash sign. The recording has started.
There it is.
There's a recording.
Yes,
we might have missed something.
Okay, so hide that. Take the speakerphone off.
Okay, say something, Cameron.
Hello.
Okay, so that's working.
Mute.
Hello.
Good. So, I don't know. Maybe, you know, it said the recording is happening. Let's hope it didn't get disconnected. But it might have got disconnected for a minute or two there.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, so.
All the good stuff will always get repeated at some point.
Yes. Often the good stuff gets lost at first.
Yeah.
So we're doing this quote. What were we just saying?
You were just starting to read the
tactility.
54 counterbalance.
Yeah, yeah, tactility. Okay, so I can look up on your blog tactility and see what you wrote, see the quotes you find.
Sure. So
you would say that the myth is that Carpenter came back from Eskimo land and made him more aware of tactility, right? That might have been in the late 50s. Carpenter was up there in the north?
Oh, he was up there all during the 1950s, off and on.
Okay. So any time in there, he's bringing information back to McLuhan.
Right.
Okay. So there's the Williams introduces acoustic space and Carpenter introduces tactile space, we'll say, right?
Maybe. I really don't know about Carpenter and tactile space. Maybe. Maybe not.
Well, somehow I read that, you know, his Carpenter's description of Eskimo culture, now called Inuit culture, brought out tactile aspects. And remember, he puts out Eskimo Realities in 59, that book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably got lots of samples of tactility in it.
That's Explorations 9.
Yes. And, mm-hmm. and Carl Williams, another guy from Winnipeg, came up with the acoustic space notion, apparently, in the seminar in 54, 55, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
The end of 54.
Yeah. So you have here a 1954 counterblast. McLuhan says, until writing was invented, say some words again.
Hello.
Yeah, it's still working. Okay. Until writing was invented, we lived in acoustic space where the Eskimo now lives. Boundless, directionless, horizonless, the dark of the mind. There's that phrase again. The dark of the mind, the world of emotion, primordial intuition, terror. Now, you put in tribal question mark?
Yeah, because I was referring potentially back to tribal loyalties.
Right.
So I was qualifying speech, which is the next word, as potentially tribal speech.
Right, and we were the primordial role of an individual in pre-tribal awareness, so typical McLuhan, primordial can be pre-tribal and also tribal. But then that's okay because you don't give up on the previous condition. It's there. So it's accurate to have it vague. You know what I mean? Primordial seems to be pre-tribal. But here, you're asking, no, it refers to tribal, too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, well, as we said before, McLuhan constantly used words in more than one sense.
Yeah.
So that's what it's, you can think that maybe he was not very precise, or you can think that his thinking was very pregnant. And I choose to regard him in the latter way.
Yeah, I see that he should blur the meanings because it's just speech or writing, and it's limited. It can't cover the whole situation. So speech is always limited. Thought is limited. So like the wake, it blurs finally where the beginning is, where that leaves off and becomes the middle and then becomes the end, right?
Yeah.
These divisions get enhanced by visual space, and they're more vague before that. So I think it's correct to not be precise. And he's saying, now, I can appear precise when I write books, But it's not about just writing books. When I'm talking, then people start saying I'm contradicting myself and it's vague and blah, blah, blah. But that is the different condition than writing is speech. And that's what he's pointing out, the differences of precision in each medium. Right?
Yes, sir.
Yes. So you say speech, or McLuhan says, speech is a social chart of this dark bog. And you say, is that tribal? So your questions are accurate. You should point out that there's a vagueness or an imprecision here, but then I explain why it has to be imprecise. Then McLuhan has speech capitalized. Speech structures the abyss of mental and acoustic space. So it structures the abyss. So the abyss is the primordial condition of the individual, pre-tribal. It's an abyss. Speech structures the abyss of mental and acoustic space. Now, Ian goes on about words shape your reality. They're very powerful, and that's what they always do. You make realities with speech. So McLuhan includes that thought. Speech structures the abyss of mental and acoustic space, shrouding the race. It is a, you know, that's what people need comfort from, right? The abyss of mental and acoustic space. It is a cosmic, invisible architecture of the human dark. Thiel used to note whenever McLuhan used the word cosmic. It was rare, and Thiel thought it as a nod to the Gnostic ideas to use the word cosmic.
Not that
he was a Gnostic, but he included the Gnostic idea. He even said to me through the Evergreens that there was some usefulness in Gnosticism or whatever you call that kind of vagueness, it can be used, not as as salvation,
sure,
but in perception.
Well, the Gutenberg galaxy is inherently Gnostic, and the Gutenberg galaxy contributed a great deal to human destiny. It was McLuhan's whole bent to try to rescue that heritage before it was destroyed by the electric universe.
Right, the electric abyss. To the degree Robert Fulford and them say that Marshall created a myth, you know, tribal man, and then literate man, and then electric man. And sometimes people say, well, there's a fall with literacy. So the fall is often a Gnostic idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the book puts on the fall aspect of the Gutenberg galaxy. Now, he has a quote somewheres.
Where, in the Playboy interview.
Yeah, where he says industrial, he has three phases. He has the fall and then the something else, the sin. Literacy was a sin, and industrial man was a fall. Do you remember that? That's the quote.
Yeah, but he brings that up to reject it.
Yeah.
He's making fun of himself when he says that in the 1940s, that was his idea.
Yeah, yeah.
That the Industrial Revolution represented the fall of man and all this, and he says that was ridiculous, and I had to become a student.
Yes.
And give up all that stuff.
Right. Okay, so speech is a cosmic, invisible architecture of the human dark, ... Radio returns us to the dark of the mind, to the invasions from Mars and Orson Welles. It mechanizes the well of loneliness that is pure, well, you're putting in pure, that is acoustic space. The human heartthrob put on a PA system provides a well of loneliness in which anyone can drown. So, pre-tribal, individual citadel conditions is about whether you're lonely or not. And the Emerald Tablets are, Ryan says, the fountain of all religions come from the Emerald Tablets, which were done 32,000 years B.C., BCE, that's the message to the little man how to get out of his loneliness. So we wouldn't know where the emotion of loneliness came from unless it's just an incompleteness that a person, a being of that era felt. So anyways, I'm just throwing in what I think from Ion about these things. These these quotes are very familiar to me. I'm telling you how I add to it. This is talking
well,
to Ion.
I think that it's accurate to say that what McLuhan is doing in all of these passages is to set up a kind of difference within human beings. A difference regarding, for example, two different kinds of loneliness. And one kind of loneliness leads to what he calls the comfort of tribal loyalties, which amounts to a kind of fall because it's an attempt to get away from loneliness that is, in fact, inherent to human beings.
Yeah.
So unless loneliness were divided between a loneliness that is what human beings are and at the same time is what human beings largely reject, unless loneliness were divided like that, then you wouldn't have the genesis of history.
Yeah.
And it's not just loneliness is like that. The abyss is like that. What are the things he says here? Metaphysical man is like that, divided into these two pieces or these two forces, one of which is inalienable to humans, and the other of which humans are always trying to escape from.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very important. Well said. And that gives us a clue to what metaphysical man is. So then you say that. So then you come in with your thoughts and you go, some? Or, you know, how do you wrap this up? So you say individual and pre-tribal awareness equals metaphysical man, which is what I was doing earlier when I was discovering the quotes. I was saying, hey, that's metaphysical man. So you come up with the same point. Equals primordial intuition equals individualism equals the dark of the mind equals the world of emotion, primordial intuition and terror, equals the human dark, equals the well of loneliness, equals the human heartthrob, equals the point in which anyone can drown? The question there. Where all of this is a question, in which anyone can drown. Then you say the Gutenberg galaxy retrieves this individualism when it eventually finds that the subject is an empty fiction. And you have after subject in brackets, its subject. So
yeah, so the Gutenberg galaxy subject.
Yeah, the Gutenberg galaxy retrieves its individualism when it eventually finds that the subject, its subject, is an empty fiction. So is the subject a literate effect or the original individual effect? What is that?
Well, again, you have the division.
Yeah.
Right? The whole motor at work, it seems to me, in these quotations, is that all of these things are at least two.
Yeah.
And trying to understand what's going on in history amounts to trying to understand how these doubles react with and against each other.
Yeah, and you know, Lewis said he wasn't into oneness, he was into two-ness. He understood that. Mm-hmm. And Ion says from very, very beginning, first talking to it, that there was always two conversations to every situation. Two conversations. That's the doubleness that's going on always in the human condition.
Yep.
It's an aspect of a self-awareness, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the galaxy retrieves its individualism when it eventually finds that the subject is an empty fiction. Does it find that its individualism that's retrieved is an empty fiction?
Definitely. That's what happens with Nietzsche, for example. It turns out that the subject, determines, for example, when a poem is finished or when a artwork is finished. With Nietzsche and then especially with Beckett, you have a questioning of, okay, if the subject needs to determine that the artwork is finished, Does the subject also determine when it knows the subject? And, of course, that's ridiculous, right, because the subject is on both sides of the equation. Mm. And the subject cannot guarantee its own reality. And so the dynamic of the Gutenberg galaxy destroys the Gutenberg galaxy notion of the subject.
So is that the mass effect of the printing press, or is it the electric environment that does that?
No. Well, I mean, the electric environment is the realization of that loss of subject. The Gutenberg galaxy subject is the subject of perspective. So when its perspective comes to a point. So the Gutenberg galaxy is really the search for the undivided point. And the electricity is structured by tactility for McLuhan.
Yeah.
So there is no point. And what electricity realizes is that the point subject of the Gutenberg galaxy is not. It's nothing.
Right. So you're saying the Gutenberg era, there's this confused individualism that doesn't get out of his dilemmas until the electric age swamps him. That's the...
Correct. But it gets out of the dilemma by completely abrogating that whole idea of subject.
Yeah.
And electricity, like magnetism, is inherently bipolar.
Right. So then the question becomes, how much can you retrieve the individualism of the primordial or the literate individual? That's where McLuhan gets into his mediacology, the balancing of that. You don't have to be totally obliterated, maybe. That was his ongoing question.
Absolutely, absolutely. So although the electric realizes the obliteration of the subject, the electric also shouldn't be taken by itself.
Yeah.
Taking the electric by itself just swamps everything. So McLuhan wants to know, how is it possible to retain these aspects of the past that are essential? And so he says the goal is to marry the moderns and the ancients.
Right, and the ancients can mean pre-literate. Pre-tribal.
There's a whole bunch of ancients.
Right. So then this is where McLuhan is, quote, a saint in the Catholic Church. He knows there's a new problem, and he is really the only one groping or is trying to say, look, there might be a way to resolve this. Otherwise, the Church is over. No more Christianity. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
That's this question he posed to people. They didn't know he was doing that, but... study, you eventually see that's what he's really, really an important anti-environment to the numbness of the Church, of what,
correct,
what Christians were going through.
Yeah, so when McLuhan converts in 37, and when he continues as a Catholic for the rest of his life, one of the things he's saying is that he was attempting to live this marriage between the ancient and the modern.
Yeah.
Right? And that he thought that the life of the Church consisted in that movement.
Yeah.
So did you make the noise in the phone?
What about the noise?
There was a noise like...
a click.
Yeah,
no, it didn't. It's a different sound. It's not the bong. It's still there. Everything's still connected.
Yeah, okay.
But it's good that you're... we monitor that because, a couple of years ago when we lost the show, it's because we didn't catch the bong.
Correct.
And so that's why we have to have three phones. So this is what we're talking about. Very important. I don't think any other McLuhanites have ever said this that I know of. They might have said it somewheres in their private conversations, a bunch of professors or something, or maybe some artist. But this is the most interesting point of McLuhan's Catholicism. He was really consciously, responsibly saying, we've got an issue here. And you can read it in the book of Revelation. You know, it's the Armageddon, the apocalypse, and all that stuff. You know, on a personal level. So what we're saying is really important to understand why George Thompson say McLuhan's not a Catholic. He's not a Catholic. Yeah, but he questioned the comforts, the tribal comforts of that, and knew that we were retrieving a pre-tribal situation, an existential suffering. So that's why he says in War and Peace and Gold Village that the big discovery of the 20th century is pain. So the exploring of pain is, in a way, the tapping into the pre-tribal loyalties and comforts of this metaphysical condition, which then he says that the Greeks were the first to discover metaphysical man, because I guess the alphabet brought in enough of individualism to get them out of the tribal, and you know, are they retrieving pre-literate tribal? I don't know.
The use of the word metaphysical, the use of the word individual there is completely different from its use or their use in the quotes that we're reading. So it's just one more example of McLuhan not caring about specific definitions.
Yeah, there's always two, acoustic and visual.
Yeah, at least. Yeah. Sure. Well, when he was at Cambridge, that was the rage, right? There was an understanding of language going on in the English school, also with Wittgenstein in philosophy there.
Yeah.
People were very conscious of the ambiguities of language.
Yeah, spoken language was starting to be made transparent. The hypnosis was dying, going away.
Yes. Let me go back, though, before I lose the thought.
Yeah.
When we were talking about McLuhan and Catholicism, and you were talking about him wanting to retrieve something of this very ancient metaphysical man, primordial intuition. And then you got into pain. And notice that in the Mass, what is going on in the second part of the Mass is the sacrifice.
Mm.
And the sacrifice, of course, is pain. And what is retrieved in that pain is the beginning of things, the creation.
Yeah.
Right? So the Catholic Mass, although it has fallen on very hard times, both in terms of its ritual and in terms of who bothers to go to it anymore, that is an attempt to re-be in the time when things first began.
Yep.
So it's in that respect, it's not different from some sort of temple to Athena in Athens, or temple to Zeus in Crete. Need of humans to remember before there was anything is perennial. And I think myself that that's what these quotes that we're looking at are all about.
Yes, and Ion says that taking the RNA drops, which keep your body alive forever. We did a recent talk on LSD affects the mind, confuses, does all kinds of things to the brain. But the RNA drops go into the cell. LSD doesn't do that. And you rejuvenate your body, and that's why you can live forever. So Ion says that taking the drops in our products is the new Mass, is the new celebration. So another quirky point I'm putting in there, that who's ever listening, they may not know what I'm talking about, but I'm just putting it on the record what I think while thinking of these McLuhan ideas. Because I thought about these McLuhan ideas, you know, for 50 years. Never could find anybody to talk about it with. then with ION, I could. Then something came from ION where I could got new ideas about it or new solutions. So I'm telling you how I see that we are completing McLuhan's probing on retrieving the metaphysical or the original mass, or what the mass meant. You know, the function of eating, you know, engaging with substance and digesting it is an act to keep yourself going, supposedly, unless you can survive without food. Maybe yogis, or you can develop yourself. So the question of how much food you need, the mass is a question. Okay, I'm going to take some more substance to keep going. That's an affirmation of, Ayn defines faith as not the way normally people think of faith. It's your self-image. So I'm going to keep my self-image going by eating. And then we have really good stuff to eat that makes it even better. So I add that for those that are interested.
One of the first things that communion says is that the human being is fed by its environment.
Yes, which can be an abyss or spirit or some vague something.
Yeah.
Were you raised a Catholic?
No, but I spent time in Greece and got to know the Orthodox liturgy and. As McLuhan himself says, that the Eastern Church has preserved the essence of Catholicism better than the Roman Church.
Yeah.
And I think that's correct.
Yeah, so, that's the argument over the filioque.
Well, but I would say that that sort of thing is sort of fallen by the wayside. The big difference between the churches now is that the Eastern Church has retained its ritual and has retained the original ceremony of the Catholic, small c Catholic Mass far better than the Western Church has.
Do people fall away from the Orthodox Church as much as the Catholic Church? Do you know?
I do know something about that, and certainly there's a lot of falling away. That one of the big problems with the Orthodox Church is that it's often very national. Mm-hmm. So there's the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox,
yeah,
the Romanian, et cetera, et cetera. And so when kids are growing up and they don't feel Romanian anymore, like their parents did, then they may not understand the language of the liturgy, and they may feel that it kind of limits them and makes them not feel American or Canadian or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's that goes on in the Orthodox Church that's different from what goes on in the Catholic Church. So there's a falling away from both of them.
Yeah.
But in different senses.
Right. I want to remind, let's remember that quote from, I think it's Prospect, where he says, you know, mid-60s men can't handle the multiple media effects in the global theater, so he doesn't get hypnotized by any particular culture. So that puts him into the existential pain of pre-tribal comforts, and then that's what you have to explore. And McLuhan is trying to help you explore that.
Yeah, I'd go along with that.
Yeah.
That's why in the past we've talked about how it's complete nonsense when McLuhan talks about him never having any problems, everything's been hunky-dory my whole life and all this stuff. It's
but then you
got to
find the next day he's telling somebody, I'm into suffering.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is the kids, the millennials and younger, they're in that statement that McLuhan said in the mid-60s about can't be involved with any medium environment because there's a nothingness that's beyond in this tech body weird virtual world. And they're not being helped how to think about it. We, today, are presenting a way for these young people who are interested and capable of thinking about it, how to look at what has happened to them. They've been made isolated. They've gone beyond tribal, literate, the whole gamut of cultural variation, and they've been put in this metaphysical condition.
Yeah, or potentially.
Yeah, well, they're in it.
Yeah, I mean,
and no one's helping them define it. They're just saying they don't talk, they don't get married, they don't do this, they don't do that. They're just dummies, you know? But they're missing the effect that McLuhan predicted, that we would not be cultural anymore in the way culture was. We have too much variety of experience every day to fucking say what it is. Most of it's not even conceptualized. Right?
So what's happened is that the emptiness is experienced in a Gutenberg galaxy way.
Yeah.
It's experienced as something out there or something beyond or something different from me.
Yeah, but that you fell out of and you're supposed to get back into.
That's right. But in fact, the emptiness is in the middle. That's the tactility.
Yeah.
So the emptiness and the loss is in fact where everything's at.
That's right.
That's at the very back of the temple. Doesn't matter if it's pagan temple or Christian temple, Orthodox temple, whatever. There's the part of the church which is not available to anybody because it's the sort of the dark heart of everything.
Right, and you're saying that's a position in the temple, an area?
Sure.
And
sure.
What, nobody can go in there? How is it designated?
Right, well, in the Catholic Church, it has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller until it's the little box holding the wafers.
Wow.
It's gone down to nothing. But in the Orthodox Church, it's the area behind the iconostasis.
So that's behind, in the very front of the church.
No, well, front or back. Usually it's called the back. In the front of the church.
Behind the altar.
Yeah, there's the, I wouldn't really say it's behind the altar. The main altar is how can I put this? The architecture of the Orthodox Church is one where the iconostasis, is the wall of the icons that has three gates in it, right? So everything in the Orthodox Church circles around through that iconostasis. So what happens is when the first half of the liturgy is the coming of the Word. And so the Word comes out of one door on the right side, looking at us, on the right side of the iconostasis. The Word comes out of the Holy of Holies in the back and comes forth to the world.
And so then, as we're looking at the back, it's coming out of our right.
No, our left.
On our left side, if you were in the back looking at us, it would be their right. So it's our left that's coming out. And it's going to go over into the other side?
Yes, but it stops, and then the passages are read from the Bible.
Yeah.
In the front of the church, and then it goes in the other gate.
Wow.
And that's... What designates the architecture or the action of the architecture that's going on is a circling from what is hidden to what is open and back into what is hidden.
What is conscious, what is unconscious. It's a drama of cognition.
Correct. So then in the second half of the liturgy, the action is in the center gate. And again, the offering comes from the back to the front, and then is going to be taken back again. But it is a instead of being this circular motion, it's the motion of the center.
It's like a pulse out and back.
Yes, exactly. And but again, there's a sharing. But the first sharing is a sharing of the literate word by the oral announcement, right?
Yeah.
And then, but the other, the next one is tactile.
Is the communion part of that?
Pardon me?
Is the communion part of that?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is what is tactile?
Yeah, that's the second. That's where you eat something.
Yes.
Very interesting. Is there a name for that part? Technical name for the hidden part behind?
Yeah, there is, and I'm a dummy, and I can't tell you what it is. But
right.
It was, I believe, in the Greek temples that preceded Christianity. I believe it was called the adouton, or adouton. And what it's called in the back of the Christian churches, I'm not sure, but I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, how do you spell douton?
I know, adouton, A-D-Y-T-O-N.
Yeah, T-O-N, as in ton, editon,
adeton.
Yeah. So that's
and
very
douton,
important.
Douton probably means to designate, to be open, and the A is the alpha privative, which means not open, right? So it's what is necessarily hidden, what can never be shown. Because it's the source of what is shown.
Yeah. What was the two terms again? Do it again. Adouton. What was it?
Yeah, adouton. It's just one word. A D Y T O N.
And O N was open.
No, the O N is the end of the word.
Right. But you had two meanings. You said something about the A D, the A, the alphabet, or.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, so the douton, that's probably related to like German deutlich, which means clear. It probably has to do with what is open, what is clear, the douton part. And then the A is an alpha privative. So, you know, many things, many words we have in English like amoral or asexual. We take the alpha privative from Greek and we use it as a not. Right? Amoral is not moral. Asexual is not sexual, right? Apolitical is not political. So the adouton means what is not open, what is not shown.
Yeah.
It's what is the hidden aspect of reality that is the source of what is manifest.
Yeah, and this is a... This architecture is a picture of what we start off talking about, the transition, the interplay of metaphysical pre-tribal and tribal.
Correct.
Yeah, the tactile interplay. And I want to add that the Evergreens channel through Michael Blake Reed saw that children, this is in the early 90s, were getting their corpus callosum expanded with the media diet that they were having, the mixed media diet. So the corpus callosum, maybe that's the interval part of the interplay of the hemispheres. That is what's being extended with the digital.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, that's what Michael saw. He saw the children's corpus callosum expanding. So that is what's happening to the millennials and younger, and the culture is at complete ignorance about how to talk to them about it. You see. They say that, you know, the kids aren't, that they don't want to be told anything because it's all on Google. And so these categories of knowledge, it's all out there. It's not you. They don't need to be told by you. But they're wondering where they are, and it's not being explained. So their indifference to categories is proper because they're living beyond categories. And therefore, there's no cultural instruction they require other than what we're talking about, which is a larger ground explanation, which would help anybody who was smart enough to get it. What we're saying here is that this is the knowledge, the expression of a fact, which is a figure ground relationship, that nobody is telling them what their dilemma is. So it gets beyond calling them stupid or socially apathetic. All these stupid categories don't deal with, they are not in any known culture anymore. They're in a new situation, and it's symbolized by the growing of the corpus callosum. So this is very important, what I'm saying here, what we're discovering through what you're saying. This is what I thought I was always had to say to young people if I was given the opportunity. I would explain what we're doing, but never had the opportunity, really. I've said it on the show, sort of talked about it with Ion, but now that we've done this, this is a really important recording, because this can be excerpted, what we're doing, or the whole show, and we're telling people something that's never been heard before in the McLuhan context.
On page 129, there's an interesting passage about this where Bob says that McLuhan says, "Bless the locomotive whistling on the prairie."
Oh, yeah.
Proclaiming the separateness of man.
Yeah, that's a tremendous statement.
Yeah, yeah. But that's more or less what we've been talking about for the last half hour, but it, just in different terms.
Yeah, and we're talking about the increasing autonomy that digital media is doing to people, the increasing separateness. But it's not a literate separateness or acoustic. It's a multi-level, weird, complex, five-bodied separateness,
yeah.
Which cannot be categorized in any cultural terms and maybe not met by any movies or poetry or editor's columns or painting or sculpture or football games. That's not, those things do not provide, quote, spiritual sustenance, which is what real art does, real good, explicit, accurate statements. They provide a comfort for the mind. It states something. You know, it's actually a beauty if it's said correctly. And
right.
People require that.
In this statement, "Bless the locomotive whistling on the prairies, proclaiming the separateness of man." It's very important that the separateness of man not be thought of as a subjective genitive. That is
right.
to say, the separatist doesn't belong to man. Instead,
right.
it's a separateness of man where man is the object of the separateness.
Yeah.
So the separateness, if we think back for a minute what we were saying about the Orthodox Church, the separateness from of the what is hidden to what is apparent, to what is not said to what is said, to what is not tasted to what is tasted. The separateness between those things is the heart of everything.
Yeah.
That separateness can never be shown, can never be described, because it's what makes the separateness between the hidden and the shown possible.
And it explains right? McLuhan's personality. He always was acting that out. He always was disconnecting himself from whatever was going on, right? He's trying to say,
yeah.
I'm not being fooled, seduced by whatever this situation is in front of us or around us. So that sentence was an amazingly important sentence. So that was one I would bring up occasionally. You know, everybody's talking about fusion and tribal unity and all the sentiments that were put into McLuhan's work in the 60s. What about this separateness point? And so then, did McLuhan talk about the internet or what was coming digital? Yeah, with the separateness point. That's what was being extended. And I think Thiel is good on pointing out the synesthetic and the co-anesthetic. The co-anesthetic is increasingly putting you in the director's chair, which is a separateness position, right? So those are terms I use to explain this strange new situation of retrieving the original separateness.
Yeah, so I forget which of the Joyce essays, but in one of the early 1950s Joyce essays, McLuhan talks about how the humanities or the arts, just like in physics, fission
precedes fusion.
It precedes fusion, exactly.
Yeah.
So that fission is the separateness that we're just talking about.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that in linear terms that there's first the one, then the other. That's Gutenbergian.
And that's nature mysticism he always detached himself from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's when he says that it has precedence, what he means is if you're going to understand meaningful fusion, you first have to understand meaningful fission.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, so let's finish. You have here, after the empty fiction thing, you say, so speech, and this is your writing, so speech, capitalize, would be the addition of some limited visuality to overwhelming orality and literacy. No, I'm going to do that again. So speech would be the addition of some limited visuality to overwhelming orality, and literacy would be the mining of this visuality for use, and the electric would be the mining of orality for use, threatening to become the complete loss of visuality into the boundless, directionless, horizonless, the dark of the mind, the world of emotion, primordial intuition, and terror. That's a very good, accurate statement. So speech is would be the addition of some limited visuality to overwhelming orality and tactility, maybe. And then literacy is later, would be the mining of this visuality of speech. Speech is the content of the alphabet, and that leads to applied knowledge, especially with the printing press, right? For use, the mining of this visuality for use. And then the electric would be the mining of orality for use. That's the wealth of culture. That's the rearview mirror. The content of our culture is orality. That's efficient causality for wealth making, or comforts of media, threatening to become the complete loss of visuality, which would be the loss of Christianity, into the boundless, directionless, horizonless, dark of the mind, the world of emotion, primordial intuition, and terror. So that's a very good statement. That sums up all that we were excavating here the last hour or so.
Notice my... I put a question mark behind a lot of these things because idea of sort of making a formula or making an equation is not fitted to what we're talking about.
Yep.
So I was doing that kind of as a thought exercise, but aware that it wasn't an appropriate form.
All right. Okay. So then we go to page 129, and what was it, 128. So remember we talked about the audience of the intellect. I think I have in my note the bottom of, we did the multiplicity of media. There's that quote from Prospect, 1962. I'll just read it. It's the one I was talking about 10 minutes ago. And I think McLuhan says, and I think it is this is an interview. So it's conversational. He says, and I think it is this multiplicity of media that is now enabling man to free himself from media for the first time in history. He has been the victim, the servo mechanism of his technologies, his media, from the beginning of time. Time is tribal. But now, because of the sheer multiplicity of them, he's beginning to awaken because he can't live with them all. See, that's a really important statement. Praise Bob for highlighting it, bring it back. Then Bob's conversational self in the blue text says, this is the beginning of, now, yeah, this is saying what I meant. This is the beginning of the autonomy, the voluntary ESP, the subtle communication of metaphysical man before speech is mental gesture, voluntary ESP. How much are you actually going to pretend you get what the other person's communicating? We're being disconnected from the electric ESP. We're being kicked out. That's just too much. So in a way, Marshall McLuhan is recognizing this isn't for him. The news is not serving an informing or warning function anymore. So that means, I guess, that he's on another level of alert, the distant early warning. The news is not warning enough. It's too content-oriented. It's too much the old media. It's not warning about the a situation where you can't live with all this and you're not in culture anymore. You're acultural. Okay? You get that?
Yeah. Yeah. The news isn't anything new.
Right. It's old. So, then we come, that's where I have this quote. So,
yeah.
You see how I'm positioning these quotes when I was composing this. We have talked our way to this issue, and that's where this issue should be, at page 128. And there it is, the Bren Stille quote. When writing was introduced in the 5th century B.C., it scrapped the old tribal traditions of Homer and Hesiod, but retrieved the private individual man, an ancient form dredged up from way, way back. Now, you would point out the simultaneity of all this, right?
Right. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Now, as you think of what McLuhan's doing here, get familiar with it, you see how beautiful Finnegan's Wake is, because it's describing this situation in book form. Joyce said to me through the evergreens, I want it so that you could not find a underlying idea. There's a void being communicated, or there's no communication at the bottom, which is this early condition of indifference to establishing anything with anybody else. That is what his book is. His book is an expression of that autonomous metaphysical situation McLuhan's talking about. Now, he probably never said it, unless we can find a quote, but Joyce was expressing that condition for him. The Wake was. So that's why he get all enthusiastic about Joyce every now and then, say, wow, this guy laid out the perfect communication. It's more important than any scientific formula. And so somebody invents things, then the society has to deal with the effects of that. Finnegan's Wake is the best warning about new inventions that are coming, new environments. You get what I'm saying?
Is it a warning or is it a...
it's a warning, a celebration. It's the ineffable. It's the metaphysical void. It's non-communication. It is awareness of it, being awake about it. What McLuhan's trying to say back there with that quote, you know, the sheer multiplicity of everything, all the multiplicity of every form of expression that Joyce puts in Finnegan's Wake, he is beginning to awaken through the sheer multiplicity because he can't live with them all. And, you know, that's the frustration of McLuhan said it was exhilarating reading The Wake, but extremely frustrating. So he's getting both things going on there. And because you can't live with The Wake. What is it that is real? Why all this stuff? You know, it's frustrating to people if they're looking for a Gutenberg conclusion. So it's a kind of yoga to get used to confronting The Wake, talking to The Wake. He says the new yoga is self-entertainment. The Wake is the book is a great means of self-entertainment with all the purposes, which are two, awakening and suffering. So it's so perfect the way Joyce wrote it. And for cultural Gutenbergian content, he's got everything there. He's got all the stories, all the nursery rhymes, all the languages, all the myths and histories of different cultures. You know, on the content, the hints of content, which is like seeing all that's going to unfold from some point at, quote, a beginning. And then you're going to see the cycle of inventions. And he's got it all. So he's actually showing what seers or whatever saw. When they saw everything, like Nostradamus, they were having the Finnegan's Wake experience. And then how do they react to that? That's the and Joyce includes your drama in response to it.
Yeah, you know that I don't claim any expertise in Finnegan's Wake. So,
well, looked at it?
What you're saying seems tenable, but I don't know.
What'd you say? It sounds what?
Tenable.
Terrible?
Tenable.
Tenable, yes.
Tenable, yeah.
Yeah, I've spent 60 years looking at it. Now, you've looked at it a little bit, but you haven't really put a long-range study of it.
Correct.
Yeah, are you prompted to do it?
Yeah, at some point. At some point, if I live long enough and my bean continues to work, I hope to do that. But I got other stuff that I have to
right.
do. And when I turn to the wake, as I wrote in a post the other day, I said that the varieties of human reality are shown in the different chapters of Ulysses.
Yeah.
But in the wake, they're shown in the individual words.
Right.
So the conclusion I came to is that every word in Finnegan's Wake is a chapter.
Yeah, McLuhan says, he says in Take Today that Joyce figured out how to make a whole universe out of one word.
Yeah. So that's makes a very heavy demand on the reader.
Yeah, so what you were just saying, I had a thought there about it. So Ulysses is the archetypes of the postures of individual mind. Finney's Wake is the archetypes of the postures of collective experience or collective media or of language or extensions of word. That's the
mm-hmm.
difference, and he says that in Cliched Archetype. So I have something to mention to you when we finish recording. So remember, I have something to tell you, okay?
Okay, yeah.
Sure. I don't want to put it on the tape. So you just reminded me of it. Okay, so so this is very important what we've gotten to. So now, so where am I going to go with this, you know? What is the tech body, which is like a crystallization of all that Finnegan's Wake is? The tech body is going to have everything in it. So how do I go from getting to the core of McLuhan, the most up-to-date interpretation of what he's wrestling with as a Catholic that is not familiar to anybody, that he's actually probed into a new problem and maybe a kind of solution, but that's not important to have a solution. So where am I going to go with that? So we have that quote at the bottom of 128, and then, yeah, I say... this is way back before social media, and I put social media in quotes, which is this is a ridiculous term. All media is social. Social media is a way of communication that's squared, which is the Android meme. The whole history of technologies as analog media in the digital becomes a squaring of it, right? So we actually call it media and say social media. I said, I'm trying to show the separateness of humans. Wow, that's pretty neat. You can understand what I'm saying based on our whole conversation last hour and a half. Had you read this part? You probably hadn't read it yet.
Oh, I had when I first read your pamphlet.
Right.
Right. This is not my first time going through it. It's not even our first time going through it. We jumped around in it, and now we're going through it more systematically.
Right.
So,
I see. That's right. It's more conscious, and this I'm talking about. I'm trying to show the separateness of humans, and that's before I have the separateness quote that you talk about, the whistling on the prairies, and I'm talking about it before I show the quote. So I'm saying I'm trying to show the separateness of humans. So that means I saw the separateness was the condition evoked by the prospect interview, where the sheer multiplicity is awakening, but also too much to live with. Right. That's leading into the separateness point, or retrieving what he said back in the 50s. So I say this is way back before social media. I'm trying to show the separateness of humans. Here, before there were societies and tribes, McLuhan is saying, quote, individual man was private. There were people moving around, and they were, quote, isolated individuals. That's what he is saying in the quotation above, the Rolling Stone quotation. And that's like today. We're isolated individuals. However, McLuhan doesn't say that's an unfortunate situation. All right? That's important. So the isolated individuals become multi-bodied beings, right? So I'm going to expand that into the five bodies later in the paper, which is on the route to the tech body. So then we have the quote from Counterblast, page 10. Bless the locomotives. This is 1954 Counterblast. Bless the locomotives whistling on the prairies, proclaiming the separateness of man. And they are bless whistling and separateness is capitalized in the original. So then I say, McLuhan says, quote, bless the locomotives whistling on the prairies, proclaiming the separateness of man, which is must be so autobiographical, right? You know, if he's out there in the prairies hearing the whistle, he grows up with that. It probably is always a prompt of meditation for him. You know what I mean? What emotions is he feeling?
As there is, or at least was, I don't know if it's still there today, but there was a rail line running down along the Pembina Highway in Winnipeg, and Fort Rouge, where McLuhan lived, butts right up against the Pembina Highway.
Wow.
So he would have heard
every
whistles
day.
There for sure. Yeah.
Maybe twice a day. That's something I could ask him about. Okay, so McLuhan says, bless the locomotive whistling on the prairies, proclaiming the separateness of man. So then I say, bless those locomotives that he had heard from his Winnipeg home. Like, I assumed that. But you're telling me something I didn't know. It went right by his home, right?
Well, it was, I would say, maybe six blocks,
mm-hmm.
maybe eight blocks away to the I'm trying to think of the direction. That's to the east is where the rail line was or maybe still is.
So the toot of the horn is like Zappa's big note. It contains all harmonies, all orchestrations, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. McLuhan quotes a German philosopher about that. I forget the guy's name. But.
Yes. In Understanding Media. Yeah, the... Yeah, that's a quote we knew a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then I say the Homer quotation above, that's the one about private man, pre-tribal. The Homer quotation above is the only time McLuhan ever talked about private individuals before tribalism. So I wasn't aware of these other quotes that you found.
Right.
His evolution, in quotes evolution, his evolution of culture always began with tribalism, then individuality with the Gutenberg galaxy. But here he's located a private individual human before any social formation.
Right.
In the next quotation, McLuhan is celebrating the separateness of man. He doesn't mean private, that means formed by visual space in the phonetic alphabet. He means isolated, separate, narcissistic, involved in his own reality. Remember how he liked to quote, you know, this famous criminal comes out of jail and said, What are you looking forward to now that you're not in jail? He said, solitude. You know that quote?
I do remember that, yeah. Yeah, I forget where it is, but I remember seeing the quote.
I think it's in Take Today. You know, the guy, he had no solitude in jail for all the years he was in there. And so he was stuck in tribal noise, right? So... he saw the value of isolation and separateness. He said, man, I can't wait to be isolated. And yet you think he's isolated in prison. He's not. There's a deeper isolation. So that's an important story. He means isolated, separate, narcissistic, involved in his own reality. Narcissistic, that's debatable, but maybe. That's why I quote the night. What'd you say?
Well, we need to keep in mind the duality that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Right. There's separateness. There's a good and the bad separateness. There's a good and a bad private. Good and bad isolated, etc. So.
And you know that there's been commentary the last five or six years about the growing narcissism in our society. That's the autonomy we're talking about, with a negative spin on it. But people are becoming apparently narcissistic. No, they're too involved in creating their own reality. Because there's no guidelines that anybody else can recognize other than their own effort to suffer and struggle through making some sense of the moment for a while. Then that's going to be collapsed, and they got to do it again. You get me? So that looks like narcissism happening in society.
Yeah, well, I personally think it is a narcissism, but it's a narcissism that hasn't recognized its own vacuity.
Yeah, its own ground. In other words, we are providing a solution to the narcissism. The unconscious new condition that people have been put into is expressed in the prospect interview that no one has addressed. Now, it's probably addressed journalistically. I mean, people are always saying, yeah, people are all by themselves or isolated and blah, blah, blah. It's all these journalistic valuations and subjective concerns about it. No technical talk about it. We're talking technically about this. Right?
Yep. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So I say that's why I quote the 1970 statement. That's the Rolling Stone statement.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rare one-time quotation talking about the human social condition before the establishment of tribal life. Now, I didn't know these other quotes, never found them again, didn't notice them. So I'm talking from, so that's why this dialogue about the book is an important part of the book, because we're adding things to what the book is said,
right?
You know, 2 years ago, and we're adding the quotes that McLuhan's cousin, Cameron McLuhan, found. A strange character. And you ever thought about that, how your name is like McLuhan?
Well, we're both Scots, although
right.
He was from northern, his family was from Northern Ireland, but the Northern Irish are Scots.
Right. Okay, so what is the name of the region that, what county is that?
Well, I mean, it's more than one county, right? It's County Down. There's several counties up there.
Okay. Is that in Northern Ireland, Belfast area, the Protestant part?
Yes.
Okay.
That's where he was from.
All right. And you're from there?
No. I do have an Irish great-grandfather, but he was from the south, from Cork. But most of my family is from Scotland, and some of it is still there.
Okay. So that's why I quote the 1970 statement. It's a rare one-time quotation talking about the human social condition before the establishment of tribal life,
mm-hmm.
which is...
And it occurs to me that the separateness of man, that could be a description of Christ. Christ is separate within the Trinity, and he's also separate as a man, eke homo. So,
like a what? A homeless?
No, eke homo,
right,
a Latin
right.
phrase.
Yeah.
You know, that man.
So he has put on the separateness of the human condition.
Well, or the inverse of that. That's in the incarnation he does that, but prior to that, he is the separate man within the Trinity.
Yeah, and then they wondered if that was equal to God or not. That was the argument.
That was the driver of many of the heresies.
Yeah,
had to do with that question, and Joyce talks about that a lot in the library chapter,
right?
In Ulysses.
So, off the top of my head, first impulse is to say the heresy is detecting it's anti-tribal, anti-social. It's not enjoying the comforts of tribal loyalties and being human. So, that pre-cultural condition is seen as a heresy by the church, right? Because it's holding together the fallen condition of tribal comforts.
Well, the heresies mostly said that either Christ was actually God, or that Christ was actually only man. And the heresies went in both directions. whereas the Catholic slash Orthodox position was that Christ was both. So the separateness of man
is both.
It's the fission that is a part of the fusion.
Yeah. So then, I think I have something to say about that. So the culture can't address that issue because you're into speech and you require matching. So isn't that like Wittgenstein? There are things we cannot speak.
Correct.
That famous line. So he's pointing to the beginning of retrieving autonomous man beyond culture, which is coming in 100 years ago with the electric anarchy, the electric obliteration of Gutenberg, and maybe that's what he was picking up on. He was intuiting this new isolated separateness condition or its retrieval.
Yeah, so you could say that the separateness of man, in one respect, has to do with the fact that when we begin, for example, begin to speak or begin to feel or begin to look, we've already determined ourselves. So the separateness of man is that we are always already separated.
Yeah.
And the only way in which we can regain our wholeness is to go back before we began.
Yeah.
And that's a very tricky sort of somersault motion that I believe McLuhan talks about a lot, but it's something that normally people can't read it because they read it in their terms rather than seeing their terms in terms of it.
Yeah, so when Buddhism or Zen says the mind is our problem, what to do with the mind? And you somehow got to get over the mind without losing it. You were just expressing that dilemma. And
yes.
So in simple terms, what do you do with the mind? And that's, what you say, the very tricky use of the mind without being trapped by it.
Correct.
That's the trick of enlightened social interaction.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's the heart of understanding separateness.
So would you say that all the great philosophers were dealing with that question?
Well, in order to be a great philosopher, you have to touch on that question. You don't necessarily have to focus on it, but the truly great philosophers do focus on it.
And that's where McLuhan is part of that tradition.
Yeah, I mean, because McLuhan didn't really care about precision and definition and stuff, I don't know that you would say he was part of that tradition, but what McLuhan did that's so interesting to me, at least, is that he undertook to rethink all of these questions that generate the philosophical tradition. So he tried to, with McLuhan, you can go back before these things have achieved formulation and try to think through how to formulate them.
Yeah, probably most of the greats were still within a bit of a cultural hypnosis. When you come to the end of the line today, that McLuhan is the thinker of that. He sees the end. He sees.
Correct.
That's so why he can be vague.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, he needs to be vague in a certain sense.
Beg your pardon?
Why he needs to be vague in a certain sense.
Yes, include that is part it? Of the expression of the spectrum. So, so then we come to an important quote, 1947, his essay Inside Blake in Hollywood from the C1A Review, October 47, pages 714 to 715, volume 55. So he says, for all the conscious intellectual activity of an industrial society, oh, he's explaining, for all the conscious intellectual activity of an industrial society is directed to non-human ends. Its human dimensions are systematically distorted by every conscious resource, while the unconscious and commercially unutilized powers struggle dimly to restore balance and order by homeopathic means. Wow, what a statement.
That's, I know you like the word homeopathic.
Yeah, that's addressing what we're talking about. When you mentioned the word, evokes all words, that's the hologramic, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole
yeah.
idea that everything is contained in little particles is in the larger structure. And then I put the two together, so I'm leading into this new idea of the holopathic, the hologram of the global theater, and its increasing homeopathic shrinking. Which, remember, homeopathy is about the shrinking, but memory is retained. The memory of the substance, or whatever it is still there, even though it's becoming more and more non-existing. That's the homeopathic mm-hmm. principle. So that's what's happening to us, the shrinking, the disappearance of us. And that's going into the overwhelmed electric tactility squared, where we lose something. Is it memory? Not necessarily. What is it that's left? Or what is it that survives the obliteration of the Gutenbergian? So, you know,
yep.
McLuhan says in Understanding Media that monofracture by fragment by manufacture. I think that's the phrase, monofracture by manufacture. He's talking about mm-hmm. the glorious service of the Gutenberg galaxy, right? It's bringing heightened individuality by its visual bias, and it's got to figure out how to survive the electric swamp, the deep state. Deep state's going to wipe you out. So
yep.
that's it's human dimensions. Now that would be, a lot of humanity is created by visual space, by the alphabet, and then the printing press. Before that, everybody's an expendable slave, right? For the pharaoh, there's no subjectivity or something. For all the conscious intellective. All the conscious intellectual activity of an industrial society is directed to non-human ends. So we're going non-human, and that includes the electric effect. So what is the human? That is enhanced by the Gutenbergian. Its human dimensions are systematically distorted by every conscious resource. So that means every new usable technology, right? A conscious resource?
Absolutely. Even slang or...
Yeah.
While the
new
clothing, new music.
Yes. While the unconscious and commercially unutilized powers, you can't commercialize Manipian satire, it seems. But today we can. But we couldn't in McLuhan's day and before. While the unconscious and commercially unutilized powers, that's the services of metaphysical condition. Of the original condition, struggle dimly to restore balance and order by homeopathic means, which would mean doing more with less. Why McLuhan, all his books are repetitions. He's not making creative affluence, Baroque spirals. He's keeping it simple. Do you know what I mean? He's being homeopathic. He sticks with the memory of what should be remembered. That's what he's expressing in all his books.
Sure. Well, if you don't believe in some sort of linear progress, if you don't believe there's anywhere to go, then that's inevitable, right?
Yeah. You then run on the spot homeopathically, slowly
yeah.
erode yourself. Well, maintaining awareness that you're still here. So, I don't know what he means by homeopathic means, right? He doesn't explain that. That's where he was aware of alternative medicine and all that stuff. Maybe he got it from his parents. But this is really early. Even though people were aware of homeopathy before the Germans and Rockefellers, changed the medical schools in the 20s, That's Carolyn's history she talks about. So there were a lot of homeopaths in the end of the 19th century. So what do you think he means? Different from what I'm saying. Dimly to restore balance and order by homeopathic means. Does that mean doing more by less?
I think so. I think he's talking about the force of the unutilized.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because small is powerful. Mm-hmm. So the unconscious and commercially unutilized powers are there. Now, digital media is homeopathic in the sense that it wakes up the individual through co-anesthesia, puts you in the driver's seat more and more, and you don't have to do much to communicate. You just press a button, turn on the mic.
Sure.
So the electric and the digital is naturally homeopathic, doing more with less.
But at the same time, as he says in the quote, human dimensions are systematically distorted. So this person sitting in the driver's seat thinks that he or she is gaining ground, but actually they're losing ground at an accelerating rate.
Yeah, it's McLuhan is not interested in cultural fame or any of those normal awards or achievements and recognition by the culture. He's staying outside of those issues.
Well, he was always interested in the phenomenon of fame.
Yeah.
He believed that fame could be manufactured, and then he proved it, that fame is a commodity that we now manufacture.
How did he prove that?
By becoming famous.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he acted it out, showed the drama, remained detached. I always remember talking to Morris McLuhan around 71, and he said, Marshall will not be doing lectures in public. He's going to withdraw for a while. There was the media ecology. You know, he didn't have to keep being famous and making more novels. He could retreat and be a nobody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's homeopathic. So I got that when Morris told me. You know, they made a point of telling people this at the front desk. He was the George Thompson, his brother, before George was. So he's the guy at the front desk, and somehow get into a conversation, and he said that to me, which was very interesting. I'm glad he did. It's like a very confidential statement. Unless he was always saying it to people, but it's interesting. He's saying we are retreating. We've had enough noise. We've been part of the noise, and actually people are turning against us. You know, Liz Jeffries, PhD. So I'll just, I don't need to be fighting all the time. You know? So he went homeopathic. So that's pretty neat to talk about that. So then where do I go next?
Let me ask a question. Just a little while ago, you said something like, everything is in the wake, just like everything is in the tech body. And you seem to be saying that there's a negative side to the wake.
No. It's predicting what technology will create. The tech body, it's just like Google and that. They got a lot of stuff in them. But the tech body.
Is there a good side to the tech body then?
Yes.
Okay.
It's going to bring a lot of pleasure, paradise to people, but it is a comfort, and you'll lose your ability to suffer. It's like a soma. This is what Einstein said: the tech body is going to solve everybody's problems. Even our cold fusion, you know, our endless electricity device is part of making a better situation for people to live more comfortable, not be based on oil consciousness, oil technologies, no pollution. I can see the seduction of the unfolding of a better technological environment that our technology is going to do. I'm not fooled by that. I'm detached from the success of it. But it's inevitable. This technological paradise is inevitable. As I used to say, there may not be many people around to enjoy it, but it will happen of its own course. So Joyce saw where technology was going, so he anticipated the tech body, and that's what McLuhan saw. Ion says McLuhan was the first to really see the tech body. So I see his talking about thinning his wake is his way of saying what the tech body is going to be. But the Android meme is an earlier phase of that.
Yeah, so I still do not really understand the difference between the Android meme and the tech body. So that's something that
We'll see if that unfolds in the rest of the book.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the question. Okay, that's good. Mm-hmm. So after that quote about homeopathy, get to page 130, and that's where I talk a bit about that quote. I say all of it, quote, is directed to non-human ends. That's the mechanical Gutenberg era, because remember McLuhan talks about in Take Today, the mechanization of humans is balanced off by the superhumanization of humans in the electric age. The superhumanization, that's important. There's a, he ends Take Today saying the supernatural. Some will call this supernatural. You know that quote at the end? When the recently achieved forms of consciousness, and asked Barry Nevitt, what's that? And he said, finning his wake. This is the last paragraph in Take Today, the yester moral. I think it is the last paragraph. So McLuhan says, you know, this amazing abundance of something. He said, some will consider it supernatural, whatever that means. But it's an important distinction. So all of it is directed to non-human ends. That's the dehumanization of the Gutenberg era. But I call it the mechanical Gutenberg era because the electric age turns us back to human-scale conditions, but also superhuman, and is organic and alive. It's not dead. Then I quote McLuhan, its human dimensions are systematically distorted by every conscious resource, while the unconscious and commercially unutilized powers struggle dimly to restore balance and order by homeopathic means, unquote. So then I say, I was discussing this with someone else the other day who knew about homeopathy. I said, quote, look at this. McLuhan's talking about homeopathy as a metaphor 70 years ago. And so I'm just pointing out, wow, look at that. McLuhan knew. So I was saying that to somebody, which I've done many times. So then I quote the article, the quote, its human dimensions are systematically distorted by every conscious resource while, and then I say, end of quote, and then, the human dimensions are distorted while the industrial entities attempt to retrieve some semblance of human scale by applying futile and puny homeopathic means. So you're getting the electric age is retrieving human scale virtually. So it's not really. It's an environment by default, like the tech body. It's an environment by default.
Don't we have to say that, for example, with the prospect essay, that electronic conditions create the means or create the situation in which people can become awake. But at the very same time, it creates the conditions for sleep.
Yes, so because again, they don't know what woke them up. See, the becoming awake is a pseudo-event because you have to be aware that the electric age woke you up from the Gutenberg. That's what you're waking up. That's not necessarily a comprehensive awakefulness. So McLuhan called it millennial ecstasies. The celebration of getting out of the prison of Gutenberg galaxy is what the 60s were all about. They thought they were being released into an open field, but that open field was even more cage-like than the Gutenberg era. And so you got the right. open society versus the closed society. So the electric environment was retrieving the closed tribal society, which we're now witnessing even more so.
So the only way out of the wire cage, according to McLuhan, and he saw this very early, the only way out of the wire cage is to understand all media.
And by sitting there. Don't go anywhere. Stay home and contemplate it. Don't
well, there is nowhere to go.
Yeah, and you get to realize that more and more. And that would be homeopathic. That's like that's another aspect of doing more with less. I mean, McLuhan, if people generally go out to socialize to get stimulated mentally, emotionally, different ways, physically, McLuhan said, wow, I've got everything right here. I just need to turn TV on for 5 seconds and I'll get some patterns, you know? Instant people, he says in the Playboy interview, we're flooded by instant people, instant social life. So why go out and look for chemical bodies? You can enjoy the stimulation of the electric situation. So that's a kind of service, but of course it's going to have a lot of disservices too for the consequences on older media. So we're on 1:30, and
You're about to get to your one of your favorite passages from Counterblast.
Right. Okay, so 1:30, and I got down to the human dimensions are distorted while the industrial entities attempt to retrieve some semblance of human scale. So you helped explain that. The electric retrieves human scale, in quotes, by applying futile and puny homeopathic means. That's me pointing out the disservices of the homeopathic.
Yep.
Okay, so then, page 135, Counterblast, 1969. So it's not private consciousness, it's individual. He says, and no matter how many walls have fallen, the citadel of individual consciousness, now that's the original metaphysical mind, right? Metaphysical
yep.
man. The citadel of individual consciousness has not fallen, nor is it likely to fall, for it is not accessible to the mass media. I remember first reading that. What? We're just learning all about what media does to us. And what? There's something there that's not affected by mass media, right? I don't think many people have dealt with that statement. It's like the big clunker in the middle of it all. Sorry, didn't mean anything I said in the last 70 pages. There's something there that's not being affected. Isn't that interesting?
Sure. I think he's talking about the source of media.
Yeah. And
the source of media can't fall to media.
That's right. And the separateness never goes away. And it's also, so you were just saying it's the source. And I was thinking that it's an effect. I'm thinking of that, you know, the multiplicity is too much for humans. So you're not being programmed anymore. I don't know if that works, but no. Let's see what I say in my explanation below.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I say, no matter how many walls have fallen, the citadel of individual consciousness has not fallen, nor is likely to fall. So I quote it. Then I said, Gnosticism believes it did fall. And then I have the quote, for it is not accessible to the mass media, unquote. And I say, more autonomy for the individual. So I understand the autonomy. I've got McLuhan's line, the mass man is not tribal, in my mind. More autonomy for the individual. We're beginning to move into the autonomous anthropomorphic physical social effect. It's not blatant anthropomorphic physical, or AAP, but I've explained that memes are also coming out of it. I'm attempting to describe how both conditions are happening. The android meme, AM, and the anthropomorphic physical, AP, the merger parallel to the separate intelligence. These five separateness quotations above help to illustrate McLuhan's vision of what's unfolding toward full development. Then I ask if that's final cause. So what are the five quotes? I'm going back up here. the Prospect is 1, Rolling Stone is 2.
The Locomotive must be 1.
3. And then Blake and Hollywood 4, Homeopathic. So is there a fifth? Yeah, Counterblast. Those are the five quotes. The five separateness quotations dealing with this autonomy, this citadel of consciousness. So I wonder what there was another point there. We're getting the separateness squared. See, I'm pointing out how McLuhan said all media is pseudo-events. So if you're a fully conscious being, you wouldn't need any technologies. So that's the romantic notion of being a god. And you talk to Christians, they don't like that idea that you can be a god. And maybe they'll call that Gnosticism or heresy. But that is an ongoing situation because the technology is making you a god. The problem is it's an environment that's being done to you. You're not doing it on your own. Unless you say it's a collective effort of technology and everybody's contributed to make everything that we have today, right? All the different contributions by cultures and societies inside the imperialist project, you could say. So this... everybody's helping to make our prison. It's going to be a very comfortable prison. And you won't be able to escape by going to the Guff. That's the sad part. So then I go into these imaginations. What time is it? It's gone about for 2 hours. I don't know. Is there more to say? Where am I going with this? College's primary and secondary imagination. So I'm talking about tactility, archetypes, tactile interplay. So I think that's I'm moving out of the separateness point. So I think we should save that for the next time.
Uh-huh.
But we can talk more about the separateness fact. So the anthropomorphic physical is humans thinking there's still a human aspect. So
is it entirely an illusion, or is it a last gasp?
Yeah, I think it's both. It's always going to be both. It's simpler to say both.
Yeah.
It's hard to make a decision. We're beginning to move into the autonomous anthropomorphic physical, social effect. So they teach courses in college now how we're in a post-human era. So as we move to what people think is post-human, that would be post-Gutenberg, they're going to be massaged into like a Brave New World kind of soma, but soma is not a drug. It's an environment. It's a tech body. So we're going to think that is an element of humanness. Or we accept the post-human as a success, and we don't care about being human. So that would be just endless semantics, arguing over what do you describe, how you describe what's happening. So I say it's not blatant AP. Not sure what I mean by that. But I've explained that memes are also coming out of it. So... memes are creativity, our culture. So we're not this raw consciousness that I guess the anthropomorphic physical comes from. So maybe I'm asking about what is the fate of the citadel of individual consciousness, which is a lot of people would say that McLuhan couldn't take the fall of the citadel of consciousness, that it wasn't correct what he was saying. A lot of people today would say all our separatenesses did collapse, did fall. But we seem to be saying, no, if you see this deeper, you'll see there's a part of you that hasn't fallen, or that you can invent a part of yourself that's not fallen. So that was the wager, they say. That was the bet or the dream that something was preserved. homeopathically, a memory. So those are all questions that we're going into now, and we're showing how that's what McLuhan was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Helped along by Finnegan's Wake. So we're not talking, you see, it's so silly in the media. Marshall said we're becoming tribal and all this stuff, right? Nothing to deal with the real issue. Now, maybe nobody famous, in cultural terms, ever gets discussed accurately, right?
Well, thinking doesn't eventuate in set conclusions. Right? So McLuhan was a thinker, and to understand McLuhan means to think along with him. And thinking along with him is a dynamic process. It's not a coming to a summation process.
Yeah.
It's not a adding up.
Yeah, that's where there's no finish line.
Yeah.
So, now William Aaron Thompson, you know, a student of McLuhan, talks about five phases of cultural history, cultural ecologies, and each one has a victim, and I think the first victim is the animal. So that's used in sacrifices and that. And then woman is the next victim, and then man, I think, and then culture. But the fifth phase in our time, well, 50 years ago when he was writing this, was the mind. The mind was the final victim. So I always think of that in relation to this thinking point. Like part of McLuhan's thinking is aware of the lack of having content in his thinking, which is expressed by Finnegan's Wake. There's, you know, whole passages where you can't find, really say what the content is. So the mind was the original problem, and that's the final victim or challenge, or we don't know what part of our minds to return, to preserve. Or what is it that we're preserving? Is the mind like the whole body? You know, there's the cognitive scientists. They like to think the mind is in the environment, and they've blurred the Gutenbergian outlines of the body. So they can't say where cognition is, or they're focusing on it in strange places. You know about that stuff, right? That trend.
Yeah, this is more or less what I meant by the disappearance of the subject in the Gutenberg galaxy.
So that would be the homeopathic disappearance of memory or the subject or the mind.
But why do you call, I don't see that, because to me the first thing that comes to mind with homeopathic is the efficacy of the small.
Yeah, the memory is preserved.
Yeah, so you seem to be, but you were seem to be saying that the disappearance was the homeopathic principle.
Yeah,
I thought it would have been the preservation.
I'm seeing the homeopathic failing, or you can be deluded into thinking it's gone. So maybe preserving accurate, with the accurate definition of homeopathy, that it preserves things, you have to know that to understand the shrinking, that the small is not a threat. People would take it as a threat.
Here you could say, just as the fission needs to be first understood in order to understand fusion, so with the homeopathic, unless you understand disappearance, you can't understand preservation.
That's right. Disappearance, very important postmodern term. So that's why right now, we know lawyers and that are working with the homeopaths, because Big Pharma is trying to wipe out all that alternative stuff, and they got a real problem with homeopathy. Because if homeopathy is correct, and the scientist that did prove that in the late 80s, forget his name, he was a friend of Baudrillard, and I discussed that with Baudrillard, because this guy was aware of what Carol was doing with Mir, that early technology that could solve AIDS in New York in the 90s. So he proved homeopathy, and then he was invaded by Amazing Randy and the skeptics, and they destroyed his lab and did all kinds of bad things. And then he eventually got, you know, isolated by the scientific community. But it was a open nerve to touch that point and say there's homeopathy. That is a idea which can become a service idea for the increasing obliteration of the tech body of us. So there's a service in homeopathy that technology, Gutenberg technology, would not want to acknowledge. So it is a big battle. They want, here's this harmless little thing, and they want to make a, they want to get rid of it and outlaw it, and their drugs do way worse than homeopathy in side effects. There are no side effects from homeopathy. So it's an irrational attack. But in McLuhan terms, it is the essence of what's happening, and McLuhan's use of homeopathy, we should hope, is correct, that it does get preserved something. He's looking for what's preserved.
You use the word obliteration halfway through your marks there. And you said obliteration of something.
Yeah, and of the private citadel. See, you know, a lot of promoters or people afraid of what Silicon Valley's doing to us. Every now and then they pop up and say, abandon all this stuff. We're going to be wiped out. As a matter of fact, here's an interesting thing that the Evergreens channel through Michael Blake Reed said. I asked them back in the 90s, when is the Armageddon? What is the Armageddon? And they said, the final Armageddon, approximately in 500 years, is when we will invent a technology and we will know that if we implement it, we will forget everything we ever knew. That'll be the effect of it. And there will be a battle over whether to press the button and implement it. So when I heard that, I said, wow, media ecology is the ultimate battle. McLuhan is telling you to study the effects, so we'll be studying the effects inevitably over the next 500 years to the point where we can see, look, we got this thing. Look what it's going to do to us. It's not an environment yet, but if we implement it, we're out. That is, to me, an obliteration of the private citadel, the end of memory. You forget everything that we know, and I don't know what that means, but somehow we don't know where we are anymore, or we don't have a right. mind to know, or something.
Yeah, I think that obliteration is happening as we speak, and that it takes place through the evisceration of meaning.
Yeah.
If words don't mean anything.
That's what I mean by my chart. Each phase is a homeopathic obliteration. And that's why I have each quadrant is a subatomic particle. You get smaller and smaller particles. We're being obliterated. That's what the chart shows. But then it predicts, anticipates, hopes for, prays for a breakthrough, which is in the sentence at the bottom of the chart, where it say, waiting for organic bodies, the spinning clothing crystals have communicate the hex advertising, the spinning close, forget what the word is. But the hex attic is what we got into, and then I found out that ion is the hex attic, the breakthrough. But how much is it a breakthrough? If you have a collective environment that gives you endless energy, electricity, and you have products that make you never die, what does that mean to you? You're forever available to celebrate your situation and enjoy technologies. Probably that leads to a meaning crisis. So we've had, you know, various phases of the meaning crisis since Nietzsche or whatever in 1850 with the telegraph. So that crisis that you're talking about, the Armageddon, with what I was portraying, because I formed that chart after the Evergreens told me about the Armageddon, so that was influencing my mind, you know, about what I thought we were going to, the final Armageddon, where we would have the choice of not knowing what it's going to do to us. So those are some of the thoughts in what I thought was making me make the chart, you know what I mean? Who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
There's other things going on in the unconscious or in my environment that are making the chart happen, too. So I'm describing what I was conscious of. So the homeopathic It's almost like the homeopathic gets tetraded. It flips and doesn't work anymore.
Well, do you run together the holopathic and the homeopathic in some way?
Well, the holopathic is the global hologram, which began with the Presidente March in the 60s, and that's been shrunk by fiber cables and the digital technology. So,
right.
So we are not inside the theater today. We're outside of it with all of media in your little 220 years ago, your Palm Pilot, now in your smartphone. We are bigger.
Right.
We have popped out of the Leviathan of the global theater. So that's where
right.
you get into the global membrane, and then the Android meme, and then the tech body. So I welcome that we got to this point where I answer your question about what is the difference.
So am I right that the homeopathic is the gigantic, the escape from which is the homeopathic, which is the miniature.
That's right. The holopathic is the huge environment of
yeah.
the 60s, the global theater.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That
uh-huh.
that shrinks, miniaturizes last 60 years. So that's homeopathic. So the hologram of the global theater is going through a homeopathic process.
Okay.
And so the question is it going to end up with an ultimate disservice or service breakthrough? So I combine,
uh-huh.
so basically I'm saying my term means it's the verb to explain the process of what happens to the global theater.
Right. And
yep.
what's the relationship between human subjects, if that's not a stupid term, what's the relationship between human subjects and this theater that becomes fragmented?
Yeah, the whole, well, shrinking becomes more and more integrated. Homeopathic is a kind of doing more with less. It's more powerful. So,
but doesn't it become fragmented into all of these different media?
Well, different, the AP becomes fragmented, the anthropomorphic physical. When you, that anthropomorphic means there's communication between you and something else. If you don't believe that you're human or anything, then you wouldn't look for something to match with. So
mm-hmm.
the AP is a way, is the final delusion that it is a human universe, right?
Yeah.
Teleologically, you know, there's a whole science of philosophy about that, that the universe is for us. So I raise that as a question. The anthropomorphic physical is a way, it's my term for the citadel of consciousness. And is that going to survive? And does it require throwing out the AP human element? So those questions are discussed a lot in a lot of fields in advanced science and computers and cognitive science, whatever they're doing, they're all wondering, we're in trouble, you know. Every now and then, like on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, people throw up, we're in trouble, it's over. And then on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, the other guy said, no, we're doing okay. We found Mr. Jeffrey Epstein, we put him away, he's not here anymore, we're okay. So you see the drama there, what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's like a bellows.
Yeah.
Going in and out. And the question will be, I think, when we arrive at the tech body.
We're always in a state where we can say we've gotten there. We got there with the telegraph and then radio. There's a slight change of frequency and all that, but the electric implosion, we never left.
Yeah, I understand all that.
Yeah.
But you often, in the sentences you just spoke, use the word we.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the word we is exactly the question in all this.
Yeah.
Whether there is even a we.
That's right. that's the anthropomorphic physical, and that's the separateness, is the we canceled out by the separateness. So yeah. You see, people like, well, I don't know where I heard this, they were discussing whether humans were becoming more psychopathic. I'm not sure where I saw that, this trend towards psychopathy, which McLuhan predicted. But, you know, as people become less controlled by cultural boundaries, they become violent. So you got more and more violence all over the place, you know, irrational outbursts. That's a big thing. That's the struggling of the AP, looking for meaning. And meaning becomes just getting a reaction. Okay, so I go shoot some people, and then they come and arrest me. Okay, there's something out there that recognizes me. I exist.
Yeah. It's like also self-cutting is part of that syndrome.
Yeah, self-cutting, what the kids do?
Yeah.
So how many people have to cut themselves to say that we've arrived? If you've got 2 million doing it in the last 2 years, say, do we have to wait till 50 million do it? Then, now we've arrived at the tech party. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, maybe the First World War is one answer to that.
Yeah, McLuhan said that the concentration camps showed that the human chemical body was obsolete. But there already was the concentration camp in the trenches in the World War I.
Yeah.
4 years of ridiculous slaughter, right?
Yeah. And similarly in the Civil War.
Yes. So you see, the electric implosion caused this global crisis, and that's why McLuhan would occasionally say, somebody should have written what I'm writing 100 years ago. It was all obvious 100 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then he would say, well, some of the poets caught on to it. But it's interesting how there is a constancy, but also a shifting, a new wrinkles added, new nuances or rhythms or radiation from what I say on the Bosmi Ecology album. We never left 1945. We've been just running on the same spot and layering over on us subsequent electronic and digital environments or variations of the telegraph effect.
Yeah, I can see that.
Okay, so that's what now I'm then going to try to say something pops out of that. First the Android meme, and then tech body. So that's we arrived at the global membrane understanding.
Yeah, so it's just about 6.
Yeah.
So maybe we should take that as a good place to start next time.
Yeah, I think this is a tremendous recording. I'm going to promote this one because we addressed the deeper part of McLuhan's Catholicism with very important points that you know no one has ever thought about or talked about.
I'm not. Maybe that's the case, but he had a lot of dealings with some very smart Catholics.
Yeah.
Including some very smart priests. So,
there might be letters to these guys that we have not found, you know, where he says that. Yeah, I would say that's possible, but they still were priests. He had the guts to not be a priest. He had the guts to say, this ain't working, boys. We're not going to win this. You know what I mean?
That's true. But he also, he wrote to his brother in the 30s, that he would, if he had known how to think about Catholicism in the early 30s, he would have become a priest.
Right, but he didn't, and I think he was lucky to not. He couldn't have been the prophet if he did that.
Probably not. He probably had to be sort of the outside on the inside.
Yeah. And he's always a question mark for people. It's once people, starting in the 60s, found out he was a Catholic, he says, what? How can this smart guy be a Catholic? These are people who weren't impressed, Protestants, weren't impressed with Catholics. So there was those prejudices. But he is a question mark to people.
Correct.
And I think that's, I don't know if you could say it was consciously staged, but that was the fate of his image. His Catholicism puzzled everybody. And people do discuss it and say, what kind of Catholic was he? You know, what was he?
Yeah.
And the Vatican, they appointed him a communication advisor, but they didn't know what to do with him.
Yeah, well, they didn't do anything with him.
Yeah, they couldn't. So he was a correct Catholic, I'd say. He was appropriately ecological, or he had the perfect pitch as a Catholic. And the only guy that I ever heard notice that was George Thompson. Of course, he was with Marshall every day, watched. And George is running over to St. Michael's Library. He's dealing with the whole Catholic environment for Marshall all the time. And so it was an accidental point where we're talking, and I don't know who said what first, and I said, well, so I don't know if McLuhan was a Catholic. And he said, you're right, he wasn't. So that was a very important communication for me with a guy so close to McLuhan. Do you know what I mean? And he had the guts to say that. He says, McLuhan's not a Catholic. Now, who would say that around him? Nobody would say that in public, in front of him, I don't think. Right?
But George, yeah, well, but that's, the meaning of that would have to be teased out for many people, like his kids. He was too much of a Catholic.
Yeah.
Right? And
but they didn't pick up his questioning of it, his coolness about it.
Yeah,
didn't realize how cool a Catholic he was.
Because, well, I don't think we have the time to...
No, that's a good point. Well, let's end on that laughter.
Yeah.
All right, well, excellent. We made an incredible recording, Cameron. You may not understand it, but I tell you, it was pretty fucking probing. We really...
Okay, good.
So thanks a lot for helping me do this.
Time, Bob.
Beg your pardon?
I say we'll look forward to next time.
All right. Well, thank
and,
you very much.
Remember that when you go off the recording, you said you had something that you wanted to talk about.
Okay. So I will disconnect. We will stop the recording. Here we go.